Yeah, great. Why I think that it's important for all of our lives, and why I think that this is a unique opportunity for biology to come together with statistics and analysis, because without the marriage of both of those disciplines, the true potential and power that exists in what I'm going to describe will never be realized. So I know that people who are interested in statistics don't often have a very strong biology background, and so what I'd like to do is just illustrate some principles, some ideas, the things that have got people so excited over the last couple of years, and then to go on and describe what some of the opportunities are. I want to start off on a practical note. I'm a medical oncologist. I treat patients with cancer when they let me. And this is just a little graph that shows what the burden to society is of different diseases. And it's a little bit bleached out for some reason, but the idea is that the diseases are listed down here on the x-axis, and the total cost is on the y-axis. And the width of the bar describes the number of people that actually have those diseases. So if you look over here, here's hypertensive disease, and what that shows is that you've got a lot of people that have hypertensive disease, a lot of people that have hypertensive disease illustrated by the width, but the actual cost of treating them is relatively small. So the volume of this block kind of describes the total burden to society. Take, for example, Alzheimer's disease, which has a very narrow width, meaning that there are very few people, thankfully, that have the disease. But look at the cost of actually managing patients with Alzheimer's disease. So you get a very different kind of shape of block. And here's cancer, where you've got not the widest, but you've got a reasonably wide cross-section. But the cost of treating patients with cancer is quite huge. And the volume of this block is actually bigger than all of the other blocks, describing that cancer is a huge public health problem and that we most definitely have to do something or we're going to drown under the burden of caring for patients with this disease. As you know, Canadians celebrated the end of the Second World War by having children, and the baby boomer cohort has really dominated all aspects of Canadian society. The oldest baby boomer is now 57 years old, and the incidence of cancer increases logarithmically with age. And so the expectation is that over the next 20 years, our healthcare system is going to be burdened immeasurably by the costs of treating patients that have cancer. And so I think that if we were to look at genomics and we were to look at statistics, and we wanted to decide where could we maximally apply our efforts to do the most amount of societal good, which is really what this is all about, cancer is the area that you would want to focus on. Now, this is just sort of a little bit of a schema that is going to throw you back to grade 7 biology, but it's probably worth just talking about. There's been a whole development of a lexicon that is a little bit silly, and it's the omics. So genomics refers to studies that look at the entire gene, the whole 3 × 10⁹ base pairs of genes that exist. And this is just, you know, the DNA bit that everybody has great familiarity with. And DNA actually makes RNA, and then RNA is converted into protein using all of this protein machinery that exists over here, the ribosomes, etc. And so if you're going to study the whole genome, well, that's called genomics. If you're going to be interested in all of those things that are transcribed, that means that RNA is transcribed, that's called the transcriptome. And this has been taken to bizarre lengths. I've even heard the medical literature referred to as the bibliome, and so it sort of goes on and on and on. But these are just sort of a couple of basic principles. And so the kind of tools that are in place currently are not going to be the tools that are in place in 6 months from now or a year from now. But this is what we have right now. We've got RNA expression analyses using microarrays. Now, Does anyone have an idea of how many genes there are actually that exist in the human body? How many do we lug around with us that make us the glorious creatures that we are? A billion? A million? 10? Yeah, that's right. It's around 35,000. So it's actually quite small. And that all of these genes have been cloned, and you can buy them just like baseball cards. You know, you can have the whole set, and they can be delivered to your lab in a forklift pallet, and that there you've got the whole complete set of Yu-Gi-Oh cards. You know, they're all there. You've got the whole set. You don't have to buy anymore. And so I'm going to describe a technique whereby you can actually interrogate all of these genes. As you can imagine, that's a lot. There's also this concept of single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, as they're called. And that if you imagine DNA is sort of the Trans-Canada Highway that goes all the way from coast to coast, that what you have are cities that bead this, and these actually represent genes. So there's a tremendous amount of crap that exists in between, like driving across Saskatchewan where you don't really see very much until you actually get, I've done that a lot, until you actually see the cities. The interesting thing is that from person to person, the actual constitution of that highway changes a little bit. And that every 1,000 base pairs of DNA, there are polymorphisms. So that perhaps in a population of people from Finland, you might have 90% A, which is one base, and 10% G. And then if you went to Japan, you might find it's 50-50, and so it goes. And these aren't mutations, but what it represents is variations in DNA that have been perpetuated through populations that distinguish us. If you look around the room and you look at the person seated next to you, they're 99.9% genetically identical to you, which is striking. And if that person happens to be a rat, okay, you're over 90% genetically identical, which is really stunning. So there's actually a very few number of genes that distinguish a person from a different person. And the challenge of clinical medicine is to be able to identify those differences in genetic composition and relate that to some kind of important medical outcome. And if you think about it, the ramifications are huge from a societal point of view. If you could precisely determine what your kid is going to grow up to be like, are they going to have antisocial personality tendencies, are they going to be bright, are they going to be tall, are they going to have blue eyes or brown eyes, you could actually determine this by an amniocentesis. And I'll just sort of let the implications of that sit. And there are other kinds of techniques where you can look at DNA methylation studies. You know, methylation is a way that nature has developed to turn off genes. There are lots of cancer genes that can be turned off by adding methyl groups, a tiny little carbon bit that can be stuck on genes that cause them to be turned off, and that there's an opportunity for looking at protein expression as well as looking at metabolism. So there are sort of a collection of things that exist right now. But I want to just quickly go through a couple of techniques and then very rapidly tell you about some things that are going on in Ontario. This is a little schematic of the way a DNA expression array is performed. And this is dead easy, dead simple. So what you do is you go to your collection of genes, the thing that you just bought for about 50,000 bucks and sitting in your lab, and you get a robot that actually takes one little gene and spots it on a microscope slide and then goes back and gets the next gene and spots it next to it at about 5 microns apart, and then you go to the next one, and so it goes. And you can actually put all 30,000 genes on one or two slides, and now you've got the whole set. And you know this basic principle that complementary DNA will stick together. It'll hybridize. That's sort of the basis of almost all molecular biology. So say you were interested in looking at the difference between one kind of cell and another. And let's say this is a breast cancer cell that has never developed metastases. It's never spread. And if this is a cell that perhaps did develop metastases, and you were interested in understanding what the difference between them. I mean, there's got to be some kind of genetic difference that determines this hugely different behavior or phenotype. So what you'd do is you'd isolate the RNA from each in this tube, and then you'd label this one so that it glows kind of reddish, and then you'd get this one and it would glow kind of greenish, and then you would take this and you'd slosh it over the surface of your slide. You'd let it compete. So if you had way, 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 way more this than that, and this was actually the target that these were going to bind to, you'd get proportionately more of these that bound there than that. It's drawn so that there's just one squiggly, but for each dot, there's obviously thousands and thousands and thousands of these. And then you scan it, and you look at the light that's emitted, and then you can make some kind of inference as to what the relative expression of one gene is versus the other. It's amazing. So you can actually do this massively in parallel. You can look at 30,000 different genes, and over a day or two, you can get an understanding of what the relative expression is. And this was actually done by a group in the United States. It's been done over and over, but this is perhaps the most exciting example. This is done by a company called Rosetta Informatics. And what they did was they looked at breast cancer cases from women that did well versus women that did actually very poorly. And they tried to see, is there any kind of genetic difference that distinguishes them? So here are the genes. You can't read their names over here, but each column represents a gene and each row represents a tumor. And the idea being that if you've got a green dot, that means that there was relatively more expression in the good prognosis ones than the bad prognosis ones, and if you've got a red dot, it means there was relatively more expression in the bad prognosis ones than the good ones. Now, if you go to the back of the room and you kind of squint, you can see that this kind of falls into two categories. You've got a collection of breast cancers over here where this group of genes had one kind of expression pattern, and this group of tumors had exactly the opposite, and vice versa over here. So it doesn't take a lot of imagination to say that you could draw a line over here separating them, and let's just see what the difference in survival is of this group versus that group. And here's the curve over here. You can clearly distinguish a good prognosis group from a poor. This is how long you live, and this is the number of people that still happen to be alive. And if you look at the traditional predictors of breast cancer survival, like the size of the tumor or whether it grows into blood vessels or whether you're old or young, and 40 actually isn't a very good cutoff for old or young. 40 is desperately young, and probably old age doesn't begin until 80. But anyway, these idiots decided to use 40 as the cutoff. And then whether the tumors actually had hormone receptors on them. And what you could see is that this is the odds ratio for developing distant disease. And the very worst prognosis is if you have a big tumor that's greater than 2 centimeters. But look, if you use this as a predictor, you've got an odds ratio of 18. So it outperforms any of these. And what it suggests is that when a scientist or a pathologist looks down the microscope and sees their breast cancer cells, it's an incredibly heterogeneous collection, and that you have a tool to look at the molecular basis and determine exactly what the difference is. This particular graph is called a cluster image map that was developed out of California in the Brown and Botstein lab. Now, just to go on, I guess, a little bit to shift gears and tell you about what I think is going to have a much greater impact than DNA expression analysis. So just a review, expression means you've got all the genes in your whole body laid out in your DNA, but certain tumors will only express a certain fraction of these. And this is what's being measured. Now, let's go back to that DNA sequence, the 3 × 10^9 base pairs. And here's the organization. You have chromosomes over here. These chromosomes, you can sort of lay one out. Here's 23, for example. And then let's just look at this particular band over here. These particular bands have various marker regions, various gene names that are found in here. And within this band, there's about 100,000 genes. And each gene can actually be resolved down to the level of single nucleotides that are represented by G, A, T, and C. And so it's about 3 million base pairs altogether. And this is the big genome announcement that was made in the Rose Garden of the White House in 2000 with then President Clinton and Francis Collins, who is head of the publicly funded genome project, and Craig Venter, who was then a principal at Celera. And they held their arms up and they said, yes, we have actually created a map of the whole human genome. But it's not still actually complete. They're still working on it, but major portions of it have been sequenced. Now, I mentioned that there's a huge amount of difference between us. Phenotypically, we're all quite different. In fact, just looking at the room, I can't see two people that look identical. So that must mean that we actually have some kind of genetic difference. So each person's genome is very slightly different, and some differences alter biologic function and how much variation exists and what variation and differences actually matter. Now, do you know that there's a huge ethnic similarity? You could see this. If you go to Finland, if you go to Sardinia, if you go to Iceland, if you go to Newfoundland, if you go to the Lac-Saint-Jean region in Quebec, they're actually, the people look somewhat the same. And this is a piece of information that's going to actually blow you away. But does anyone want to guess how many founders populated all of Japan? The whole of Japan derives from less than 1,000 people, which is quite amazing, actually. And the whole of Finland derives from less than 2,000 people, meaning that this was a founder group that populated that and contributed the entire gene pool, so that there's relatively genetically homogeneous, but if you compare those people to other parts of the world, there's going to be more and more variation, which is quite interesting. The Lac-Saint-Jean area in Quebec was actually populated by something like 800 people who immigrated from France. And there was one guy named Tremblay who had 12 children, who had like 12 children, who had 12 children. And this one guy and his wife are responsible for over 8% of the entire gene pool of Quebec. Which is amazing, if you think of it. But it explains an awful lot. It explains an awful lot. So here's just sort of what I was talking about. So here are four people. And this would just be sort of your genetic sequence over here. T, A, T, C, blah, blah, blah. And person one and person two are relatively the same here. But look, person three over here has a T instead of a C, and so does person four. So this is a single nucleotide, and it is polymorphic. So this would be called a single nucleotide polymorphism. And if this happens to be, say, in a gene that's an enzyme that metabolizes a particular drug, you might find that when this person gets the drug, they get horribly toxic, and when this person gets the drug, they don't have any effect at all. Or this could be a gene that determines things like growth hormone potency, or there's a whole variety of things that have been described. So this sort of is the basis of phenotypic difference. Now, how do you actually measure these? There's a lot of high-throughput techniques, and this is an example of the biology of Moore's Law, because each 6 months it seems that the ability to purchase more and more analytical power for less and less money is just so obvious and apparent. It used to be that to determine one of these polymorphic sites, it would cost about $3.50. Now the cost has come down to about 16 cents to determine one of these polymorphic areas. And this is done through multiplexing technologies. And this is an Affymetrix chip. Affy is a company in California that pioneered photolithographic techniques for actually growing oligonucleotides on the surface of arrays. And this is just a little example of what it would look like, that each one of these columns represents either a G, A, T, or C in a particular person. So you could sort of read the sequence of DNA. This might be G, A, T, G, T, T, daddy, daddy, daddy. But if you actually look at this person over here, you find that they've got two spots over here, meaning they're heterogeneous, that they inherited one particular chromosome from their mama and one from their daddy, and it was a little bit different over here. They were polymorphic. So by going through this, you can actually measure now 10,000 different areas of polymorphism for about $500 US. And the company is coming up with an array that can measure 100,000 areas of polymorphism for about the same amount of money, which is stunning. Because what that means is that you'll very quickly be able to get 100,000 pieces of discrete information that will characterize a person's genome. And then that, coupled with clinical information, what kind of disease they got, what kind of disease did their parents, their children, their drug response, toxicity, hopes and aspirations in life, the whole thing, can you actually draw a relationship between this very complex genetic set and these phenotypes? And that up until now, biology has been focused on one gene, one disease. Great examples of this. There's the cystic fibrosis gene, one gene that causes this deadly disease, cystic fibrosis. There's fetal ketonuria, one gene that causes this metabolic disease in children. But what we know is that most of the diseases that are the scourge, at least of Western civilization, asthma, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, are not related to one gene, but they're related to a very complex interaction of a huge collection of genes. Imagine what you would need to look at 100,000 different polymorphic sites and say, what's the interaction between these? Which 20 or which 40 or which 1,000 actually interact in a meaningful kind of way in order to determine this particular phenotype? And the analytical tools that are needed to actually cope with such huge data sets are just only now being developed. So these SNPs are like gold. To be able to determine what's polymorphic is the absolute beginning of any kind of meaningful study to try to find out a relationship between polymorphisms and disease. And there is a consortium that was developed with 10 corporate partners and 5 academic centers, and the idea is that they want to identify at least 300,000 SNPs in 2 years. And it's all going to be placed in the public domain. And this is interesting. Why it's going to be placed in the public domain is that the pharmaceutical companies are desperately frightened that these SNPs are going to become the subject of proprietary protection. So that if you've got a drug, for instance, and you want to market it, and you find out that you can predict who's going to respond by measuring 10 SNPs, but you find that your competitor has actually patented those 10 SNPs, you can't really use that test unless you strike some kind of royalty and licensing agreement. And so what's going to happen is that even though the SNPs will be in the public domain, over the next 5 years, there's going to be a feeding frenzy where companies are going to be associating polymorphisms with particular disease phenotypes. And then that's patentable. It's a use patent. So that you can say, measure these 20 things, and it predicts who's going to respond to my drug. Here's a test. I want to patent it. I want to license it. I want to sell it as a kit that's going to come along with my drug. So there's a huge imperative right now to find validated clinical sets where you know exactly what the outcome of the disease is going to be, and very rapidly, using high-throughput techniques, determine what the polymorphisms are, and then relate statistically one to the other. And there's going to be a tremendous, huge need for high-quality statistical analyses in this area by pharmaceutical companies and academic organizations that want to actually to capitalize on this genomics revolution. Now, let me just tell you how such a study would occur. And this is almost too simple for this or any audience. But first you want to discover and catalog the SNPs in human disease, and then you identify the variants that I've described. You test these variants for association with human diseases, such as this, and then with the catalog, with the association, you can actually make some kind of inference. So I want to just take this one step further and tell you something that probably is going to be the most profound piece of information that you're going to hear probably in the next 5 years, which is maybe that's not true. There's lots of profound things. But if you think of it, that if there are 3 × 10⁹ base pairs of DNA, and on average there's a SNP 1 every 1,000, so that means there's 3 million SNPs that we all carry around with us. How many different human beings could you produce that are different from one another? It would be 2 raised to the power of 3 × 10⁶, which is a huge number. But it doesn't work that way. And this is why. About 50,000 years ago, the first human beings populated Europe. And this was around the time of the last great ice age. And that by calculating the amount of diversity that exists within Caucasian DNA right now, the prediction was that for 20 generations, the whole population of Europe never increased by more than about 50 individuals, hanging on by their fingernails, living under the most savage conditions, obliged to breed with themselves over and over and over again. Actually, it doesn't sound so bad, but this is what happened for 20 generations. And it was the same thing as taking laboratory mice and back-crossing them. And you can do this, and the rule of thumb is that if you back-cross mice for 7 generations, they're more or less homogeneous genetically. So what we were left with 50,000 years ago were basically back-crossed human beings, the so-called population bottleneck. And they were more or less equivalent genetically. And then what's happened over those 50 years is that there have been sporadic mutations, neutral, they weren't really selected for or against, that have been perpetuated throughout the population. And during this relatively brief window of human evolution, a handful of polymorphisms have actually been introduced into the genome. Now, you know, the genome isn't like a photocopier where you just sort of peel off a copy with every generation, but there's recombination. But if you've got 2 chromosomes that are sort of the same, homologous, do you remember this meiosis thing where the 2 come together and one whips to the other side and one, well, while they're touching, you can get sort of bits that will just exchange back and forth. And depending on how far apart individual loci are from one another, the amount of linkage can be different. So that if you've got 2 genes that are stuck right to one another, they'll always cross over with each other. But if they're separated by a huge difference, they might actually be part of 2 different bits that cross over. And over the last couple of years, this group in Boston has discovered something really quite amazing, that there are blocks of recombination that exist. And the size of the block is about 22 kb, 1,000 base pairs. And so these blocks have no recombination in them, and then there's sort of a recombination hotspot, a bit where the scissors just love clipping there and flipping it to the next chromosome. So you have this sort of like modular almost. So you've got 1 block, 2 blocks, 3 blocks, and the average block is 22 kb. And I don't mind throwing numbers around because I'm confident that this audience is comfortable with numbers. 22. So if you've got on average 22 polymorphic sites, 22 SNPs, 1 per 1,000, you'd expect the number of different haplotype types that are in there could be 2 to the 22nd. But it's not. It's about 3 on average. And the reason why it's 3 is because of all of those Europeans, the 50 of them, breeding with each other for all of those generations, because they beat out all of the heterogeneity, and you are left basically with none. And the three kind of different haplotypes that are in there are all related to a few mutations that accumulated over those 50,000 years. So what this means is that, and here's just this example, here's a haplotype block, and say there are going to be tons of SNPs here, but there might just be four SNPs that are so-called informative. And so if you looked at, say, these four SNPs over here, this might define one haplotype, A, T, G, and C, and this might be the other one, A, G, G, and C, and likewise over here. If you were wanting to be economical, all you'd have to do is measure this one, and you could determine that you had this particular haplotype and not this one. So you've eliminated a huge sequencing or analytical burden by just simply measuring this base or that base. And this is actually quite stunning, because what it means is that in Caucasians, you can actually get by with measuring only about 50,000 SNPs. And that will give you the whole key to genetic diversity. Now, does anyone want to guess what the most genetically diverse population in the whole world is? Guess? Anyone? A population that never experienced a bottleneck ever because of the warm, beautiful climate that they lived in and could reproduce freely? Guess? Come on. Africans. Africans have a much greater amount of genetic diversity. The haplotype blocks are smaller, and the number of alleles are greater. I had mentioned Caucasians actually have very little diversity. There's another ethnic group that has actually the same structure in their DNA as Caucasians. It's just that the allele frequency is a bit different, and that's Asian. So if the anthropologist suggests that from those 50 people that populated Europe, some of them said, bugger this is too harsh, I'm moving off to China and Japan, and took that amount of restricted genetic diversity and actually populated the Orient. So from a genetic point of view, Asians and Caucasians are very, very similar. It's just the frequency of the alleles is different. So here's kind of a little example of how you can use this in a practical sense. But here's the gene up over here, and the black bits represent exons, and the bit in between represent introns. And it doesn't matter what that is. It's just sort of a schematic of the gene. And then here's SNPs, which each one of these lines might represent an area of polymorphism, one base or the other. What you could do is, if you identified that these are three blocks that exist within one gene, because a gene is about 60 kb and a block is about 22, so it would kind of make sense, you could actually just have to measure these haplotyping polymorphic sites, and you could be very economical, and you could actually determine what's called gene tag SNPs. You could actually determine what kind of allele exists within this gene just by measuring these particular gene tags. Now, reproducibility is key in this business, and that there have been a whole flurry of publications that have said, I have found the secret to one particular disease. And that if you look at about 600 studies where positive associations have been reported, and that these particular positive associations have then been tested again by a different lab, only about 166 have been sustained after three or more times, and that if you go beyond three, only about six are consistently replicated. So what it means is that the techniques that we're using to actually determine what's relevant and what's not, even though they might be statistically relevant, even trying to understand the hazards of multiple testing and all of the other things that are inherent in this, the methodology sucks, okay? It's just, there needs to be something better, that even though the best efforts over here, when you actually reproduce it on an independent data set, maybe in a different country, it's junk. So there's great potential, but there's actually great hazards. Just to give you an example of some things that have sort of been reproduced, is there's this drug called rituximab that's used for treating lymphoma. It's expensive. I mean, it's really expensive. It's about $25,000 a hit. And that its activity is actually correlated with a polymorphism in an immune molecule. So this is an antibody that attacks the malignant cells, and here's another immune molecule. So that's actually relevant. And that you would think that we should test everybody for this polymorphism. The only thing is, the company's just not so interested in developing that, because what do they want to identify people that aren't going to respond? They would much prefer that everybody gets the drug. Epirubicin is a drug that's very important in breast cancer, and it's related to an enzyme that metabolizes this particular chemotherapeutic. And then this is another great big drug for breast cancer. It's the last couple of years. It's really made a big impression on the community. And its half-life correlates with a polymorphism in cytochrome P453A4. So this is an interesting thought, that drug efficacy and toxicity may be predicted by pre-treatment determination of specific genotypes. So there's real practical implications. This isn't some esoteric ivory tower kind of undertaking. And here's just, I think, probably a real poignant example, that children get acute lymphocytic leukemia, and it's devastating when they do. And they're treated with a drug called 6-mercaptopurine. But what's been discovered that over the years, that it's metabolized by this enzyme over here. And there's a variant allele that exists that has severe toxicity. So that you treat a kid and they might get cured, or you treat a kid and they might die of liver toxicity, which is the lady or the tiger kind of thing a little bit. And there's a test that costs about $5,000 per quality of life year saved. So it's a genetic test to determine what kind of genotype you have, and it can make a big difference. And so this is an example of something that's thought to be worthwhile, but there's an interesting kind of relationship between a lot of parameters that we determine whether genetic testing is really worthwhile or not. And this is a simple little curve where it says this is the cost of quality of life year saved over here. $150,000 is thought to be a lot. No one's life is worth $150,000 a year. And that if it's down to zero, well, really you're really doing something worthwhile. And so it depends where the value lies on what the actual risk of having the severe consequences and what the cost of the test is. So for instance, if the test is dirt cheap and the chance of finding something is really high, then the cost to society is very low. If you have actually a very expensive test and the chance of finding something is really low, you're going to spend a ton of money before you actually find something that's worthwhile. So I just show this to illustrate that even though you can statistically demonstrate and validate a test that's going to predict something on the basis of a statistical analysis of genetics, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have clinical relevance, because there are issues of cost effectiveness and incidence of the disease. And more importantly, is there something that you can do about it that's going to make a difference? That it's devastating to identify a disease for which you have, like Alzheimer's disease. Like, what's the good of a test to tell a 40-year-old that they're going to have Alzheimer's disease when there's nothing that they can do about it? Now, I'm running out of time, and I just want to tell you about an initiative in Ontario called the Ontario Cancer Research Network Tumor Bioprofiling Project. And about 2 years ago, in some dark oaken cocktail lounge, the political power brokers thought that it would be worthwhile spending some money to promote cancer research. And they realized that cancer is a disease that has huge social consequences, but it also has huge economic benefits, which is kind of a little bit of a twisted and bizarre thought. But if you think of all of the effort that goes into cancer research in Ontario, what was the last big product that came out of all of that activity? Insulin. And that was, what, in the 40s or something like that. So we've really fallen behind places like San Diego and Boston and Maryland. We don't have the same kind of biotechnology infrastructure. And so the government said, here's $100 million, and what we want you to do is develop translational cancer research programs. But translation doesn't mean from the bench to the clinic. It means from the bench to the pharmaceutical park or to the corporate boardrooms in Basel. This is the flow of information. And so the Tumor Bioprofiling Project was launched as an effort to provide a resource that's going to be of value to Canadian and Ontario researchers that are going to be able to take this and participate in this kind of genomics revolution that I've described. And this is going to be a collaboration between surgeons, biologists, and statisticians. And if you ask me what the most important group is, it's going to be the statisticians. So it's true. You all know that quotation from Disraeli, though, don't you? That there are three kinds of lies. Everybody knows that, right? Yeah, okay, I won't tell you. So here's the vision and mission of the Ontario Cancer Research Network. It was created in January 2004 with a budget of $100 million and a four-year mandate. And we're to be recognized as an international leader in translational research, and we're supposed to accelerate the development and testing of promising new cancer therapies in order to bring innovative treatments to patients sooner. So it has a societal component, an academic component, and a commercial component. So there's a variety of different ways that the money is spent. $71 million is just simply being given to scientists to do good research. $13 million is being given to support infrastructure for clinical studies, that once you've got a drug that needs testing, you need nurses, you need a clinic infrastructure, you need data managers. So there's the $13 million. There's $12 million that's being spent on a virtual information network, meaning patients can find out what trials are available, are they candidates for it, they can be interviewed by the Canadian Cancer Society, they can travel to other places to get the latest and greatest. But the most important and most exciting aspect of the whole thing is the Tumor Bank Network that's going to be worth about $10 million. And what our goal is to collect about 20% of all of the cancers that exist in Ontario. That's 10,000 samples per year. And they're being preserved in liquid nitrogen to maintain the integrity of the biomolecules, RNA, DNA, protein. All samples are being linked to patient data with frequent updates of the outcome. We've spent $1.5 million on a database. It's got a beautiful little web interactive front end so that you can query the database using Boolean type of search tools in order to come up with an understanding of what actually exists within the database currently. And that what we're going to do is make some biologic and genetic measurements on a subset of tumor samples to give us all a little bit of a substrate of data to play with. But the goal would be that the sustainability is going to come from pharmaceutical companies that are going to search and they're going to say, wow, you guys have 500 samples from patients that were treated with our drug and you know what the toxicity is. What we would like to do is we would like to get access to these samples in order to find out some kind of genetic determinants of response. And we feel that that is going to be the thing that's going to make the program sustainable, the economic development aspect. So I just want to conclude by saying that I think that genomics is not a flash in the pan. I think that we're actually getting now to the nitty-gritty of cancer biology. About 10 years ago when I was in the lab, I cloned a gene and spent the last 10 years trying to figure out what it did. I never did find out. And here's the opportunity to actually take tumors and to find and to do this in reverse and say, these tumors are going to tell me what genes are actually relevant to tumor biology. And now I'm going to go back to the lab and I'm going to determine exactly what their biologic function is so that I have a much greater and accurate window on what truly causes this scourge. And the OCRN is front and center in this process. And that we're going to be successful if patients have a broader access to cancer therapies and that hospitals will actually see these kinds of genetic studies as being central to the business that they're in, and that unless you were part of this train that's leaving the station, you're very quickly going to be practicing third world medicine. I want industry to feel that Ontario is the ideal place to spend their research dollars, and I want academics to be able to do research that's better than any other jurisdiction because of this particular infrastructure. And I want our glorious government that's up for re-election to be recognized internationally, I guess that would be Niagara Falls, USA or something, as an innovator in supporting cancer research. So thank you very much.